The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Leeds.
Happy November. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Leeds. Happy November. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Leeds. Okay, from the Cannot Tell a Lie department, I don't know who won Game 7 of the World Series yet. It's really only Wednesday because we're leaving for Philly tomorrow for the Philly Bike Expo. The game doesn't start for another few hours here in Cleveland at Progressive Field. But, you know, regardless of the winner, be it the Indians or the Cubs, it's been a well-fought battle and no one needs to hang his head in shame. Two great teams, two great towns. How's that for diplomacy? So let's move on to our show this evening. Back in 2015, Molly Herford wrote an article for Bicycling Magazine about a young woman by the name of Aisha McGowan. The article was reposted this past week and caught my attention. I don't know how I missed it the first time. The title of the article is, "This Cyclist Could Become the First African-American Woman to Go Pro." So my first thought was, wow, that's so cool that we finally will have a woman of color in the pro peloton. Then I thought, why is that the reason Aisha should be singled out? So I decided I wanted to talk with her. And to say that Aisha McGowan is refreshing and fun would be a gross understatement. At 29 years old, she still has the spunk and curiosity of a teenager while exhibiting an incredible maturity about the world around her. She's a music teacher who races a bike. After we leave Aisha, we head to Washington, D.C. to speak with Rails to Trails director Keith Laughlin. I always like checking in with Keith before an election because he lives and works in D.C. and has a unique perspective on what's going on there. He's also nearing the end of a challenge he took up early in 2016 to walk 2,000 miles, quote, along the trail, end quote, which isn't exactly the way it sounds. We'll talk about why he's doing it and why walking is on his radar. Finally, we're going to jet up to Toronto, Ontario, to talk with Marlene Kohler, the executive director of the Waterfront Regeneration Trust. Marlene has spent the last 20 years developing and leading the innovative partnership, regenerating the Great Lakes waterfront through the creation of a spectacular 1,600-kilometer Great Lakes waterfront trail. It's a full plate tonight. Let's get right to it and welcome Aisha McGowan to the Outspoken Cyclist. Aisha, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So evidently, a year ago, so I'm really late to the party, Bicycling's Molly Herford published an article about you and your desire to become a pro cyclist. But there's really a lot more about you that I want to know besides your cycling as a pro and in competition. Can you give us a little bit about your background and then we'll bring you up to speed on cycling?
Well, I'm from the East Coast, which I only say because now I live in California, so it's a clear distinction I like to make. Born in Georgia, and I grew up in the Northeast in New Jersey, and I went to school at Berklee College of Music in Boston, and then I moved to Brooklyn, New York, but I started commuting in Boston, and eventually, while living in New York, I took up racing. So before I was a bike racer, I was a commuter and a bike advocate, and just someone who rode a bike. I wasn't necessarily what I would consider a cyclist. But now my definition of that has changed.
Yeah, it tends to do that. Cycling's sort of like a bug. Once you get it, it's hard to get rid of it.
For sure.
It's interesting that you were born in Georgia. You grew up in the Northeast. You have absolutely zero accent. You have, like, the perfect English-speaking voice.
Jersey's pretty non-regional. It doesn't really have a...
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I have a really good friend from New Jersey, and he sounds like he's from New Jersey. I don't know. Anyway, you are a music teacher, which is really cool. What kind of music are you teaching?
I teach preschool music at a Montessori school, and I also teach piano to elementary and middle school boys at a private school.
Nice. Nice. So piano is your instrument, basically?
Well, no, my principal instrument is violin.
I see.
But piano is easier to teach to young children. I've taught violin to young children. It is far more of a challenge, but still fun.
Yeah.
And incredibly rewarding when they get it.
So at one point you were the director, I don't know, are you still the director of In Tandem, or is that something that you no longer are?
I was never the executive director. I've been the director of programs, kind of in and out and kind of consulting since I've moved, but I'm still involved with them as much as possible remotely.
So explain the organization. I'm a tandem stoker, and I think that what you do has to do with the captains more even than the stokers, yes?
I have been organizing the programs, helping to organize the programs. So I pretty much have been doing administrative stuff remotely to organize rides and special events for the captains and the stokers. So I deal with everyone. Pretty cool.
There is a really interesting program out on the West Coast. I wish I could remember the name of it, but it has to do with finding captains for blind stokers. And in a lot of cases, the stokers already own the bikes, which I always find very interesting, you know, that they're always looking for captains to ride.
Yeah. I don't know. There's an organization in Berkeley. I know the acronym is BORP, but I don't remember what it stands for. Something like Berkeley Outdoor Recreation. I'm making things up, but it's something like that.
Okay.
And I know they have a tandem program, but I don't really know how it works. I wanted to volunteer with them, but the timing has just never lined up. So still working on that.
I'm always impressed by people who are willing to, knowing how hard it is to be a stoker, I'm always impressed by how people are willing to give so much time and effort to taking stokers who really can't see. I mean, even though all I see is the back of my husband and side to side, I can still see and I know what's going on. So I'm just trying to envision. You know, sometimes I close my eyes, but not very often. So it must be really interesting. So can we talk about your racing?
Sure.
All right. So bike racers, when I think about them, usually start as young, you know, young kids. They start racing like in the juniors or even before that, intermediates, and then they'll come up through the ranks. But you didn't start racing until you were an adult. Tell us how you became interested in racing a bicycle.
I mean, I'd been riding like a track bike in the street, like sixth gear. In urban cycling culture, I guess. I don't know if there's like a term for it. But I've been doing that for a while, and there's kind of an underground community of street racing and that type of stuff. But I joined We Bike NYC, which is a group in New York City that is specifically focused on women's empowerment. So they offer rides and clinics, and you can just try things out with like-minded humans. And through them, I actually found In Tandem, and I also did a track clinic at Casino Velodrome in Queens, New York. And that's how I got into the idea of sanctioned racing, because it was just really fun. And I think it stuck with me long after I completed the clinic. It wasn't like I did the clinic and immediately decided I was going to be a bike racer, but it did plant the seed and, you know, put the bug in my ear to go for it.
How old are you now?
I'm 29.
Do you think that women can begin racing later than men and do well? Because you're doing well.
Thank you. I think because there are fewer numbers, there is more room to do well, maybe. But at the same time, I feel like it's much easier for men to find races with enough people in them to get points for their upgrades the way the system is created.
Well, that's a good point.
So, I mean, there's a give and take for both. I don't think one is necessarily easy, but I do feel like there is more space because women's cycling is still developing.
Well, yeah, it's developing again. You know, this isn't the first time around the block for it. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Aisha McGowan. She is in California. She broke her teeth in on bike racing on the East Coast. So you pretty quickly climbed up to a Cat 3 and won the New York State Road Race Championship. That was in, what, 2015?
Yeah, so I won the 2014 Criterium Championship as a 4 in New York, and then got my upgrade by the end of the first season, and then I won the state championship as a 3 for the road.
Wow.
On the road.
Have you moved up to Cat 2 yet?
I am a 2. I did it.
That's awesome.
And I think I'm about halfway to 1, but I'm not in any rush. At this point, I can kind of do most of the things that I want it to get done before becoming a 1. I don't need to be a 1 to do the amount of learning that I want to do. I can enter pro races at this point.
Have any teams started looking at you yet? Have you talked to any teams?
Not yet. Working on that, too. But I think it'll happen soon, maybe. Crossing my fingers, hoping for it. You know, we'll see how the season goes and work from there, you know.
The article in Bicycling Magazine in 2015, Molly Herford's article, you know, made the distinction, which seems weird to me, that you may be the first African-American women pro cyclist. Do you know Nelson Vales, by the way?
I do know Nelson.
I want to know why you think other African-American women and men aren't racing bikes. I mean, we're talking about Nelson racing way back in the 80s and at the Olympics here. This is 2016. And we're not seeing a lot of color in the peloton, which is very disturbing in some ways to me. What do you think? What's going on?
I mean, for me, I think it's a matter of representation. I think there was probably even less color in the peloton before he did what he did. But for women, that never really happened. There hasn't been any representation. So when you talk about African-American cyclists, the only names that really ever come up are Nelson Vales and Major Taylor. I mean, in more recent times, you have, like, your Rahsaan Bahati and Jason Williams, who are both, you know, technically, I guess, in this era of cycling, and they're doing really well. But as far as the Grand Tours go, you don't really, you know, have anybody African-American representing in there. I think for the men, there has been actual opposition that has, you know, kind of steered them in a different direction.
Why do you think that?
I mean, if you speak with them and there's, you know, public interviews or public things where, at least for Rahsaan Bahati, he has expressed some situations that weren't friendly that he's been in and some, you know, trouble that he's faced. I can't speak for Jason Williams because I don't really know his story, and he's still on the rise. You know, there's still room for him to grow. So I'm, you know, gunning for him to get there also.
Have you inspired any younger girls? And I do mean I'm using the word girls, meaning girls who say, ooh, I want to do that. Look at her ride that bike and go fast. Are you hearing any of that yet?
Yeah, there's a few girls out there that are going for, you know, for now, going for it. I hope they'll stick with it. But, you know, I tried a lot of things in my youth that I didn't stick with. But there were a few things that I tried that I did stick with. So I'm hoping that, you know, I'll encourage and inspire enough people that at least a few of them keep going. And then it'll keep growing from there. And they'll inspire a few more. And they'll inspire a few more. And it'll just have a chain reaction. And I think it might take a while. But, you know, that's all a part of it. You got to start somewhere, and I feel like the start hasn't happened.
Who are your heroes in the sport? I mean, if you look at who's racing today and who's raced in the past, besides Nelson Vales, I mean, that's on the, you know, the other gender side. On the female side, do you have cycling heroes, people to whom you'd like to aspire?
I mean, the person I closely relate to as far as, like, getting into the sport later in life is Evelyn Stevens.
Yeah, true.
She's also from New York. We went to the same road clinic and started in the kind of the same place. Obviously, she just knocked it out of the park pretty much immediately. But I'm just inspired by her ability to just get in there, go for it. And when she was ready, she retired. You know, she retired this year. So
yeah, she hung up her wheels.
Yeah, she did a lot in the time that she was there, though, you know.
That's true.
33 by no means is an early retirement in cycling. She just started later than most people, you know.
Right, right. That's true. That is true. Yeah, I really was kind of sad never to have spoken to her while she was racing, but I'm still hoping to get a hold of her and, you know, at least get some retrospective ideas from her and thoughts. Although she did say in her Velo News interview with Kaylee Fritz that it was her last interview. I hope that's not so. What kind of bike are you racing?
This year, in 2016, I raced a Cad 12, a Cannondale.
Nice.
I did mostly criteriums, so I wanted an aluminum bike, which helped because I did go down a few times and my bike was okay. But before that I raced on carbon the whole time and it was okay, but I never really crashed. Like, this is the first year that I've been, you know, aggressive enough to have that unfortunate experience.
Yeah, you're brave to race crits, I'll tell you. They are scary, very scary.
They're also really fun.
Well, they're fun to watch. For sure, they're great spectator events. And I'm, you know, if you like to go fast and you like to get in there shoulder to shoulder, yeah, they're fun. I don't know. Scares the, you know, bejesus out of me. What's your favorite food? These are the fun questions.
Spaghetti.
Oh, awesome. You didn't say pizza. I'm so happy. All the guys say pizza. It's really funny. Spaghetti's good.
I do enjoy pizza, but spaghetti is my favorite food.
Well, as a musician, what kind of music do you listen to?
Kind of all over the place. I mean, the thing that I've had on repeat recently is Solange's latest album, A Seat at the Table.
Nice.
Yeah, it's very, very good. I've been enjoying that a lot.
And do you have a pet?
I have three pets. I have two cats and a dog.
What kind of dog?
A pit boxer.
Nice.
Mix. His name is Emoji.
That's a great name.
Yes. Very cute.
It sounds very cute. Well, I am going to be watching you and hope that your career just zooms right into the stratosphere. It sounds like you have such a good attitude about the sport and racing, and you have a solid career behind you that, you know, it's not like you're coming in and having to scrape for every sandwich and every beer, you know. So that's kind of cool that you actually have a life ahead of time. You know, a lot of these young men really have a tough time coming up in the sport. So I'm glad to see that you're coming into it from sort of a mature place.
Yeah, I think that helps a lot. I don't think if I started as a teenager that I would have stuck with it. I'm not sure that I would have. My early 20s were interesting.
Are we not going into those?
As far as my maturity level. So I've grown a lot since then, and I think I'm in a really good place.
What's your big goal for 2017? Do you have your sights set on anything in particular?
Well, 2016 I focused on pro crit, and in 2017 I want to focus on pro stage races. So I really want to work on my time trialing abilities, which at the moment is not something I'm confident about, and just sticking it out in the long road races.
Because your time trial is a different bike, too, really.
It's a different bike. It's completely mental. It's just putting out watts and learning how to suffer and not putting on a wheel and hoping that, you know, works for you. It's just all you, whatever you can produce. And so it'll be a growing experience. I mean, I've done a few, but not at the pro level. And since now I'm a two, I'm going to have to compete against, you know, the best in the sport, and I've got to be ready for that. So I'm just mentally.
And you're in a good place in the country for that. You know, you've got some big California tours and some, you know, west-ish stage races. So, yeah, Colorado, Utah. How do you do at altitude? Do you know? I do terrible at altitude.
I don't. I have no idea. We're going to find out, though.
I'll bet you are. Well, I hope you have a wonderful 2017 season. I thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. Good luck with your career.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Bye.
Ayesha McGowan joined me from Palo Alto, California. What a delightful young lady. I wish her a lot of luck in her racing career. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be back in a moment after a break.
Starting on November 19th and running till New Year's Day, Lake Metro Parks presents Candyland Has Gone Wild, the Wild Days of Winter Game at Penitentiary Glen Reservation in Kirtland. Move along a life-sized game board in an indoor wonderland to discover the many flavors that nature offers. And be sure to check out special activities from 1 to 3 p.m. every Saturday afternoon throughout the exhibit schedule. Penitentiary Glen Reservation is located at 8668 Kirtland Chardon Road in Kirtland. More information at lakemetroparks.com. Click on events.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and as promised, we're going to head up to Washington, D.C. to speak with Rails to Trails Director Keith Laughlin. Hi, Keith. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's always good to catch up with you.
Thank you, Diane. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, here we are, less than a week away from what has been probably the most contentious presidential election cycle I can ever remember. The country is spinning every imaginable scenario. But I always like to talk to you because you have a very clear picture of what's happening, especially when it comes to domestic issues that affect us, transportation, infrastructure. Let's take a look at a couple of scenarios. What do you believe a Clinton administration might bring to the transportation department? Anything different? What do you see?
Well, at this point, I think the signals that we're getting from both Clinton and Trump is that both of them want to make a major investment in infrastructure. With Clinton, it hasn't been real clear exactly what that means, but I think that it's a combination of things related to transportation, water infrastructure, broadband, etc. But I think that there's the opportunity here for a pretty significant increase in federal spending to push transportation infrastructure.
So both administrations would do that, you think?
Well, Trump has been, from what I understand, there's a lot less detail. In terms of what he would do, but he has said that he wants to do that. Yes, as a job creating economic stimulus measure.
Well, would a lot of things change in the transportation department? It seems like Anthony Fox has gotten some things done, and before him, we had Ray LaHood. Do you see big changes there?
I mean, I think it's possible that we could see a continuation of the change that's been occurring over the course of, the last 8 years. But I think a lot of that will also depend upon the Congress, because this would have to emerge from Congress, because it would take legislation to do more than what we have in current law. And if I had a real concern about that, it is that a lot of times when this comes up, transportation infrastructure, there's a strong assumption that what we're talking about is more money to build more highways. And that, I think, is not what the country needs right now. I mean, I think there's certainly need for maintenance on our existing roads and bridges, but I think we could get an awful lot more bang for the buck by investing in trails and walking and biking.
Oh, well, of course, you and I absolutely agree on that. I guess one of the questions I have about a change in the administration at the top is, if there's no change in Congress in terms of, you know, Democrat, Republican, will either of these presidential candidates be able to work with Congress better than they did not work with President Obama?
Yeah, that's a really hard question to ask, because I think there's just an awful lot of unknown variables here in terms of what's going to happen next Tuesday, in terms of what the composition of the Congress will be. So it's really hard to speculate, but it would be my hope that we end up in January with the new president and the new Congress that at least start off wanting to work together on something.
Right. Anything.
Anything.
Right.
But I think that the one thing, this infrastructure investment, is one thing that I think is potentially has bipartisan support. And so I think it's an opportunity to find some common ground between the parties. And so our task there is to sort of ride that wave, but to make sure that some percentage of that money goes into walking and biking, and that it just isn't a highway-only kind of new initiative.
Well, it's interesting you said that, because I can remember when I spoke with Secretary LaHood, he emphasized that transportation and infrastructure are bipartisan issues. They are not political in terms of either Democrat or Republican. And that's always stuck with me. So one can only hope, right?
Yes. And what he is describing is the way that it's traditionally been. That's not exactly how it's been the last couple of years, but I'm hoping we can get back to that.
Yeah, that would be really, really nice. Well, want to talk about some rails to trails?
Sure.
Yeah, me too. So we can pretty much figure out what's going on there. How was 2016 compared to other years in terms of, you know, people using the website and trails and just the kinds of things we want to see with rails to trails? How did you fare this year?
It's been a very good year, and for us, it's been sort of a transitional year. We're launching; we've launched a lot of new work that I think is really cutting edge stuff. We are in the process of launching what will eventually be a dozen major big infrastructure projects across the country, building regional trail and bike systems. And so our goal is to create some national models to really show how you create an interconnected system of bike trails within a community, and that this will then demonstrate how that's done, and we want it to then be replicated everywhere in the country. So we've had major progress in getting that off the ground in Baltimore, in Wisconsin. We've got a also, we're just beginning a project here in Washington, D.C. We've got another one in Philadelphia, and we're doing a lot of work out in your neighborhood as well, where we're trying to extend the trail from Pittsburgh to Cleveland.
Oh, that would be really, really nice. We would like that.
Yes, and then we want to go from Cleveland to Toledo and from Toledo to Chicago.
Wow. So is this similar to what the East Coast Greenway did north to south? It sounds like this is more east to west-ish in a way.
Yes, it really is. It's east to west. And I think that what we're looking to do is to create these active transportation systems in these metro areas so that we've got something, you know, happening that is kind of local, but we want to then knit them together so you can go from place to place.
Well, I think that's one of the problems we've seen right along is that trails will be built and they kind of like start someplace and end someplace, but it doesn't take you anywhere. You know, you sort of have to like drive to the trail, ride it, and then where do you go from there? So I like the idea of connecting them, especially if we're coming into urban areas.
Yes, connectivity is the buzzword of the day in terms of all of our work, because we now have so many trails on the ground that what we can really accomplish now, I mean, you wouldn't have a road system if the roads didn't connect to each other, because they wouldn't take you from where you are to where you want to go. And so now we're really focused on taking the trails that we have and connecting them to each other in these networks within communities and between communities.
I want to talk about something you did this year, though. Tell me about your walking challenge. What is this 2,000 miles?
Well, I decided that, well, a big piece of what we do is we build trails that are used by both cyclists and by walkers and runners and, to some extent, equestrians and skateboarders and on and on. But a big part of our constituency is walking, and we are part of trying to create a national walking movement. And I, frankly, was in a situation where I needed to lose a little bit of weight, and so I sort of set a challenge for myself that I was going to walk 2,000 miles in 2016. And so it's been something that is a little difficult getting it off the ground, but it's become so now ingrained in my daily behavior that I hardly think twice about it.
How many miles a day do you set as a goal for yourself. So I wear a Fitbit and I look at it every day and I'm like, oh, I had a good day or I had a bad day. But what's your goal every day? How are you judging that?
Well, I do a minimum of 5 miles a day, but I usually average between 6 and 7.
Nice.
So I'm actually ahead of where I need to be to meet my 2000 goal. I'm at about 1,850 miles, and I think I'm going to get to 2,000 miles by Thanksgiving.
So you said others could join the challenge. Did others join you?
Yeah, we've got a Rails Trails page on the Fitbit website, and we have 50 to 60 people who are doing the same thing, and it's really inspiring because I have a real hard time keeping up with these folks. They are putting on, doing an incredible amount of walking, and it's just fun to check in and see, how much other people are doing.
Yeah, I have a friend who wears hers and is addicted to it, and she puts on like 150,000 steps because she runs 8 miles every day, and I'm like, that's not fair. I'm not even going to try to compare myself to you. Tell us what's new for 2017 with Rails to Trails. Are there any new trails opening? Are there any new trails that are going to, or old trails that are going to be rehabbed? What's going on?
What we're really doing is trying to get this big project off the ground, and I think we're doing that. But a big piece of that is not specific trails, but we've also been developing these new GIS-based analytical tools. We've invested about $1.5 million over the last 3 years in this research project to help create new tools for local communities to use to build to plan their trail systems and to build what we call low-stress bike networks. And so we've been working a lot in developing these tools over the last 2 years, and then in 2016, we did a lot of beta testing where we've been taking them out in the real world and seeing how they work. And then 2017 is going to be the year where we really roll them out, make them well-known, make them available to activists, community leaders, et cetera, so that we can help to get more bike infrastructure built. That's one of our biggest goals for 2017, is to take that research project, which has been kind of an internal thing, and really take it public.
Yeah, I remember, I think we talked even a few years ago that this project was going to start, and now it's ready to roll out. That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's amazing with technology today how much more we can give to communities as tools to get this work done. It's no longer like if we build it, they will come. We can really get much more sophisticated in our advocacy.
Which I think is a really good thing. It's interesting that, I had some stem cell replacement therapy on my knee a year ago, and it's worked so well that now I'm over 800 miles on the tandem this year. So now we're starting to like put some bucket list goals, and one of them is the Katy Trail for next year.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, it is just one of everybody's favorite trails.
It is a wonderful trail. It's definitely in my top 10, but I've got a lot of favorites. But it's definitely there. I am personally one thing I'm looking forward to is we're gonna host a ride this next year on the Great Allegheny Passage. We haven't done that for a couple of years, but that is also just a wonderful trail. That's the one you can go. If you want to take the whole thing, it's D.C. to Pittsburgh.
Oh, so you're going to go south to north?
Yes, we're going to go it's southeast to northwest. Yes.
Somebody said that there were some parts of that trail that are having some structure problems. Is that true?
Well, I'm not sure which part you'd be talking about, but the CNO Canal part always has some maintenance issues. But the Great Allegheny Passage is actually from Cumberland, Maryland to Pittsburgh. That's about 150 miles, and it's just a wonderful trail. And that's in good shape.
Yeah, that's not too far from us. So if you could connect Cleveland to Pittsburgh, that means we could get on that trail and head south to D.C. That would be so much fun, right?
Yes, you can do that. And as I said earlier, we're now working to connect that to Cleveland. So pretty soon you'll be able to get on in Cleveland and ride all the way to Washington to see me.
That would be awesome. Are you planning to be in Philly this weekend?
No, I'm not. I know there's an event there, but I am going to be meeting with some activists in Wisconsin.
Well, that's pretty cool. We're going to be at the Philly Bike Expo. I thought, wow, I haven't seen Keith in a while. That'd be cool if he was there. Well, we will keep watching. We will watch the election. We will watch infrastructure and transportation and for sure Rails to Trails. Tell our listeners how and what they can get involved with Rails to Trails. There are different programs that you offer.
Yes, if you get on our website at railstotrails.org, you can find lots of different things where you can find information on our trail building work, our trail policy work, where we're currently, we have a petition to the new administration to encourage them to invest in trails and biking. And we also have our trail finder website, traillink.com. And this year we expect we'll have 7 million visitors.
Wow.
In 2016 to that website. And it just shows how high the demand is for people who are looking for safe places to ride.
Wow, that's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. Because I remember, again, when the Trail Finders system came out, and it was like, well, we're hoping to get a million, and now look at you. Well, that's really awesome. I hope you have a wonderful fall, a wonderful holiday. Gosh, the holidays are really coming up quick, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Well, maybe we'll catch up with each other in 2017. Thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Diane.
Bye-bye. Well, Keith Laughlin, always a pleasure to talk with him, Rails to Trails director in Washington, D.C. We need to take a break and then head on out to our news department, which is like, you know, 2 inches away from me. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back. Hey, Diane Jenks, The Outspoken Cyclist here, back for some news. Years ago, well, really no, decades ago, the very best indoor bicycle rollers were built by a very eccentric guy named Al Kreitler. He was always seen with his pet Yorkshire Terrier kind of tucked into the front of his bib overalls. He was an Oshkosh Bagosh guy. He passed away in 2001. But his rollers live on. And this week, Bicycle Retailer published a short article about the product. This comes from Bicycle Retailer, Grand Junction, Colorado. Kreitler Rollers has announced it will stop selling product through distributors and will focus on dealer direct sales. The roller manufacturer, which is owned by Mountain Racing Products, said it will concentrate on supporting key dealers. Tim Fry, the president of Mountain Racing Products, said, quote, "The Kreitler brand was built with the focus of a great dealer base, and we want to ensure that the end consumer is being properly supported and serviced by the best dealers." So I am glad to hear that the product is still available. I am also happy to hear that it is still made in the USA, because everything that Al Kreitler ever shipped always had a little USA sticker on it. We have a recall, unfortunately. This one's from Fox. The CPSC and Canadian authorities have approved Fox factory recall of 6,100 Fox Float X2 shocks in the U.S. and 1,200 in Canada. Fox is recalling all 2016 and some 2017 model year Float X2 shocks because the outer sleeve can rupture, allowing the sleeve to come in contact with other bicycle parts or the rider, posing a fall and injury hazard. The shocks were sold individually and installed on YT, Giant, Pivot, Intense, Ibis, Scott, Trek, GT, Noli, Norco, Rocky Mountain, Diamondback, Morpheus, Foes Racing, Orbea, and Canyon Full Suspension Mountain Bikes and Frames. Recalled shocks and bike models can be identified at ridefox.com/recall. Fox has received 7 reports of the outer sleeve rupturing, but no injuries have been reported. Consumers are being told to immediately stop using bicycles with the recalled rear shocks and return them to the place of purchase for a free repair. Consumers unable to return their bicycles should contact Fox toll-free at 855-360-3488 from 8 to 5 Pacific Time, Monday through Friday, or email recall@ridefox.com. So you might remember we spoke with pro rider Phil Guymon back in June of 2014 when his book, Pro Cycling on $10 a Day, was published. Well, let's fast forward the 2+ years, and Phil is actually hanging up his pro race wheels. In a beautifully worded blog on October 31st for VeloNews.competitor, Phil recounts his time as a pro and why he doesn't see a future for himself in that role anymore. It's really an interesting perspective, and I was taken with his clarity and his thinking. If you'd like to read it, go to VeloNews.competitor.com and find Phil Guymon journal, Don't Call It Retirement. We often complain about either no coverage or middle of the night coverage or lousy coverage of bike racing, but suffer no more. Trek has stepped up and they are supposedly delighting the fans with free race streaming. This comes October 31st. Long-suffering American cyclocross fans got a reprieve from the world of shady online streams and VPN trickery when Trek announced this past Friday that it will stream 10 major European cyclocross races. The agreement includes the entire DVV Insurance's Trophy Series and schedule Sudal Classics races. This comes on the heels of the Trek CXC Cup races, which the brand streamed live from Wisconsin, one of the few domestic cyclocross races to do so. Working with retired legend Sven Nys, Trek is also sponsoring the FIDEA team this season. Broadcast will be available on Trek's homepage. So you can read more. That came from Velo News. Again, Trek delights cross fans with free race streaming. And that's it. We're going to take another real quick break, and then we're going to head on up to Toronto, Ontario, to talk about a very interesting Trans-Canada Trail, the Waterfront Trust. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and as promised, we're going to head up to Toronto, Ontario, Canada, to speak with the executive director of the Waterfront Regeneration Trust, Marlene Kohler. Marlene, thanks for joining me on the show this afternoon.
Oh, thank you very much, Diane. Happy to be here.
Well, you know, I always find great guests in unusual places, and my friend Jen, who works at Whole Foods, and I've known her for a while, came up with somebody last year, and then this year, she came up with the Waterfront Trust Trail, and I went, I don't know what that is, and then I realized I kind of did, but that brought me to you, and so here we are today. Tell us about the Waterfront Trust.
Sure. Well, the Waterfront Regeneration Trust has been around 21 years. Today we're a charity, and we've been a charity for about the last 13 years of our existence. That, to me, is pretty significant because we used to be a government agency. And the fact that we were able to continue the work that we started as a royal commission and then a provincial agency, continue that work as a charity, and not only just continue it, but actually grow it by leaps and bounds, is something we're very, very proud of. So been around 21 years, started as a Royal Commission, the Royal Commission, held hearings with a whole bunch of people. We had thousands of people come out, and basically the question is, what's wrong with the Toronto waterfront? And there was loads wrong with the Toronto waterfront, but it was people who said, you know, a good way to begin to remedy them, Mr. Crombie, a good way would be to create a trail and start linking all the places along the waterfront. So the idea of the trail actually was inspired by people. And we made that the centerpiece of the recommendations, and we've been working on implementing that in our various corporate forums ever since.
You know what's interesting? Why don't you bring that down to Lake Erie on this side so that people in Cleveland would turn out? We would do the same thing if we had that kind of foresight, but evidently we do not, unfortunately. So tell us, who is David Crombie?
David Crombie, love this man. He is a beloved community leader in Ontario. I think one of his real claim to fame is he was one of the most popular mayors of the city of Toronto, which is a very big city in Ontario, and in fact in Canada. He was the mayor from 1972 to 1978. He was called the Tiny Perfect Mayor, and it's a name that he still gets from everybody that meets him. This is a guy, when I first met him, you know, I was in my 20s, and I'd go into, you know, you go into an elevator, and you're there with your boss, David Crombie, and people would recognize him, but they'd be quiet, and we'd all be standing eyes forward, not David. He'd turn to that stranger, stick out his hand, hi, how are you? Start asking him questions, very curious about people, very interested in what they had to say about the place they lived in. And so, you know, he was, he made his life, as I say, as the mayor. Then he went into federal politics, where he was a very successful cabinet minister. But when he left, he was put in charge of a royal commission, and that's what started the whole trust, the Royal Commission on the Future of the Toronto Waterfront. And I have to say that, you know, he turned 80 this year. You would never, ever guess it. The guy is so youthful, so energetic. And to this day, the governments often put him in charge of very contentious issues. Anything where you need to bring people together and bring the best out of them to tackle a challenge, David's the go-to guy to get that done.
Cool. Well, I did see a picture of him. He looks like a happy person, and it's good. You know, it's nice to have a boss like that, but now you're the boss. You're the executive director. Tell us what your duties are.
Well, okay. My favorite job description, which I got in 2014 at a strategic planning session with about 100 of our partners, is this. Kiss and kick butt and know when to do both. I love it. But really, it's, you know, my job is to champion the vision. It's a long trail that we're talking about, and somebody has to be the keeper of that big, broad scope. So that's my job. The second job is to care, feed, and grow the partnership needed to make the trail successful. And this includes government, to be sure, because much of the waterfront lands in Canada are in public ownership. But it also means reaching out to great organizations like the CAA, that you have AAA, we have CAA, and other non-government organizations such as the Share the Road Coalition, Ontario by Bike, and we have a national trails organization called the Trans-Canada Trail. They've been a very important partner to us in the last 4 years. And the last thing is to get money. Attract public and private investment to the trail and its program.
Sure, sure. Fundraising, it's always one of the hardest things a nonprofit has to do, and it needs to be successful, which obviously it has. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Marlene Kohler. She is the executive director of the Waterfront Regeneration Trust Trail. And now we're going to talk about the trail, because that's what really interests me. So where does the trail start? Where did you actually put, like, your first piece of the trail? And I know it's heading west.
Right. So the first section of the waterfront trail was created between Hamilton and a place called Quinte West, which was essentially the Lake Ontario watershed. And no sooner did we launch that in 1995 when the communities to the east and the west of that started to say, hey, why just stop the trail there?
What about us, right?
Yeah, exactly. And we, you know, we were like, we were surprised, but we were elated, and we began to go out, and we have grown in major chunks now since 1995. The first chunk was adding Niagara, getting us to Niagara Falls. The, you know, a third major chunk was getting all the way to Quebec along the St. Lawrence River, and then in 2013 we added Lake Erie, and this year we opened up the stretch between Pelee Island, the first island to formally be part of the trail, all the way up to Grand Bend, which is halfway up the Lake Huron.
Wow.
Next year we're doing our first northern expansion between Sault Ste. Marie and Sudbury. Of course, I was born in the Sioux, and you know, you have Sioux, Michigan. I remember going across the river many, many weekends. I was having a good time. And we're I'm personally very, very proud to be able to bring the trail to the northern sections of the Great Lakes along the North Channel. And again, that's possible working in partnership with TransCanada Trail.
So far, how many kilometers of trail are there?
There's right now today, there's 1,600 kilometers from Grand Bend to Quebec. Next year, we'll add another 380 kilometers.
Wow.
So we'll be up to 2,000.
What is the surface of the trail? Is it similar to like the Erie Canal, which is kind of like a, you know, sort of like a gravelly trail, or is it paved?
So the trail is a combination of several things. It's path, usually paved, but there are sections where there's a firm granular surface. We also take advantage in order to create a continuous trail that's signed. We use neighborhood streets. And when you get into the more rural areas of the province, we have to start using secondary roadways. And in some cases, we have to use some of the King's Highway up in the northern section. Because the more remote areas, the notion that you're going to have a separated trail is a legacy piece. It is our long-term vision that it'll be completely off-road and at the water's edge wherever environmentally feasible. But to get there, we're going to have to use this incredible mix of our transportation system.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. You say that you have 10 bicycle-friendly communities on your list. Can you enumerate a couple of those for us? I mean, Cleveland is probably not one of them.
No, but I love your waterfront, though, Cleveland. But no, the bicycle community, the bicycle-friendly communities we're talking about are on the Canadian side. And in that area, Windsor is the only community that is right now bicycle-friendly. But I will tell you, that is a gift from the States. There's this awesome woman named Eleanor McMahon. She's now the Minister of Tourism in Ontario, and we've never had a Minister of Tourism that is so committed to cycle tourism as we do now. About 10 years ago, she created an organization called Share the Road Coalition, and she went down to the States and learned some of the great things that you are doing to promote cycling, and one of them was creating these bike-friendly community programs. So she brought that up to Ontario, and it's been an incredibly helpful tool to mobilize our communities to participate in a more effective way in initiatives like the Great Lakes Waterfront Trail.
Wow. I just wrote her name down because I just spoke with Barbara McCann, who is the sort of architect of the Complete Streets Coalition here in the United States. And then she now works for the Department of Transportation at the executive level.
She probably knows Eleanor.
She probably does. I would imagine she does. You know, some of the things that are really interesting are the historical sites that you kind of either pass through or pass by. What are a couple of the historical sites for those people who love history and would like, who will probably come up and do the trail this summer?
Absolutely. So everything, you know, the waterfront is the first place where we began to settle. It is the place where our First Nations settled as well. So there is loads of history. And that history is celebrated through museums, through forts, and through plaques, and through architecture. So, you know, it's not hard to feel steeped in a time, bygone when you are along the waterfront. But a couple of favorites. I have to do some shout-outs. The Lost Villages in Cornwall. The Lost Villages in Cornwall pays tribute to a time, not that ancient history, but it's from the 1960s. When, and this is something that both our countries did together, they, of course, wanted to create the seaway to allow greater ships to come along the St. Lawrence River. And in order to do that, they had to flood on the Canadian side 12 main streets. Some churches, they had to dissemble some of the churches before the flood because they thought it would be sacrilegious to just flood these churches.
Sure.
But what these communities got instead were these little strip malls on the new highway, and their whole history was buried underneath the rising waters to accommodate shipping.
Wow.
The story of how they did that back in the day is fascinating. Not just the engineering, but the community stories, how the kids would leave one morning and then be brought to a new home because the homes have just been picked up and relocated. Anyway, it's absolutely moving. It's very fascinating, and I didn't know it until I went to Cornwall and visited the Lost Villages Museum. My other, you have to stop at the forts. There's Fort York in Toronto, Fort George, Fort Henry, Fort William, Fort Malden. All these beautiful forts, they're landscaped beautifully. Many of them have history enthusiasts that recreate, those early years of our time, back in the 1800s. And, of course, a lot of them tell the story of first of settlement and then when Canada really began to sort of wake up to itself as a nation through the War of 1812. And,
wow.
In terms of museums, there's something that Canadians love. If there's a piece of history, we'll make a museum around it. We have the McLaughlin Woodworking Museum in Kingston. We have the Oakville Museum. We have the National Air Force Museum in Quinte West. And kind of my new favorite is the Bush Plane Museum in Sault Ste. Marie, which is right on the waterfront trail. You can go into some of the bush planes and sit in them, but we've got loads of museums. And when we do our annual ride, we take people on a bike tour, I am always struck with how people stop to read those interpretive panels, and they always make time to go into those local museums to get a sense of what the local history is about.
When do you do your ride?
Well, we do it in August. So this year, in 2017, it'll be our 10th anniversary, and we're also celebrating Canada's 150th birthday.
Oh.
And we're going to go national park to national park, August 6th to 12th.
Nice!
And it is fully supported by the CAA. Our CAA is outstanding. I don't know if your AAA does this.
No, and I already know the difference. I know about your CAA.
If you're a member and you have trouble with your bike, you can call CAA and they'll come and help you out. Unbelievable. But they manage our mobile support for us during what we call the Great Waterfront Trail Adventure. It's a multi-day cycle touring. Our idea is to create a cycling holiday that will make Ontarians and visitors fall back in love with the Great Lakes, recognize their beauty, understand that you don't have to, we need to invest more time and energy to keeping them beautiful and protecting what's important to us about them. And this ride, I think, inspires that depth of passion and sentiment again in people.
Listeners to how to get to the website, and I really have enjoyed talking with you. It's been a really interesting conversation. What's your website, Marlene?
It's Waterfront Trail, 2 T's, all one word, .org, and we really hope there's loads of detailed maps and trip suggestions. So if you prefer to do your own thing, no problem. If you have questions, give me a call. I'll probably be the one on the other end of the line, but helping people plan their trips is something that we love to do.
Well, thank you so much. Have a wonderful holiday season, and we will talk again as you complete your trail.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Diane.
Marlene Kohler joined me from Toronto, Ontario, to talk about the Waterfront Trail. Sounds beautiful. I would love to go do that. Maybe we'll add that to our bucket list. That's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed our guests, Aisha McGowan, Keith Laughlin, Marlene Kohler, and next week we will be back with a brand new show. Once again, we'll be in Philly tomorrow, Sunday, November 6th. We will be there from 10 to 4 at the Convention Center downtown on Arch Street. If you can't get to Philadelphia, but you can get outside and it's nice, go for a ride. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.